Now, compared to the Chilcot report and to the UK's decision to go to war in Iraq or to the Panama Papers with its 2.6 terabytes of data, equivalent to roughly 168 million pages of text, the recent legal decision on the South China Sea dispute is relatively modest, only 500 pages. But according to my first guess, the decision by the Permanent Court of Arbitration in Philippines versus China is a game changer in international law. Without a doubt, like most legal documents, it's not light reading. Many analysts are expecting China to lose their claim over sovereignty of so much ocean territory, and that their arguments of historical rights to rocks and reefs had little merit. What people didn't expect was the learned judges being so direct, so emphatic in knocking back the Chinese arguments. One commentator in The Fin pointed out that they thought the tribunal would give the Chinese some wriggle room to negotiate without losing face, but the judges put the boot in. With me in the Melbourne studio, although I think we should probably go downstairs and broadcast from our bomb shelter, is Douglas Guilfoyle. Douglas is Associate Professor of Law at the Eucalyptic Monash University. And Douglas, have you read all 4 pages yet, or 500 pages yet?
It only came out on Tuesday. I've made an effort, but I'm not all the way there yet.
But you will have to, of course, given your exalted status. Before I get you to explain the court's decision, tell us about the actual Law of the Sea Convention.
Right. So the Law of the Sea Convention was concluded in 1982. It has 166 parties out of 193 UN member states, so it's very widely ratified. It effectively presents a holistic framework for the legal government of the ocean. Some details need to be filled in by other agreements.
I can just hold your breath there. Amongst the conspicuous non-signers would be?
The United States. Yep. However, China ratified it at the original signing ceremony. Sorry, signed it in 1982 at the original signing ceremony and ratified it in 1996. So they've been in there for a while. But the important bit of it for this discussion is that it contains a rarity in international law, a compulsory dispute settlement provision. So any dispute concerning the interpretation or application of the convention can be taken to a court, or in this case, to an arbitral tribunal.
Douglas, why didn't the US sign it? I know they're very funny about signing international treaties and conventions.
The bottom line is it includes a deep seabed mining regime that involves paying royalties to the International Seabed Authority, and for some in the US Senate, that was tantamount to allowing an international organization to tax US enterprise.
Now, will this, in fact, affect how the dispute might be resolved?
That's hard to say. I mean, it's set out the legal rights of the parties. That's going to frame any negotiations. As a lot of commentators have noted, China's in some ways backed into a corner. This is a hard position to back down from. But if other affected states, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Philippines, use this as a moment to stand with the Philippines and say, this is a statement of our rights as well, then that breaks down China's attempts to deal with everyone bilaterally.
You were telling me off air that you were very busy at the moment answering media calls, including quite a few from Vietnam. This is a very significant moment in regional history.
Absolutely. China's nine-dash line claim for something in the order of 15 years, 20 years, has put a lot of states in a difficult position where allegedly China was claiming some form of rights very close to their own coastline.
Nine dash line. What's that?
Okay, so it's an odd thing, but officially on maps drawn by the Chinese government since 1948, there's been a line encompassing something like 80 or 90% of the South China Sea. Exactly what it means has always been open to debate. It's possible it was just meant to say everything within this line, all the islands are ours following the defeat of Japan. That might have been what it originally meant. But China's kept it very ambiguous as to what precise legal rights it thought it had within that line.
We've done any number of programs on this issue. and what are generally described as the Spratly Islands are deemed by the Court of Arbitration to be called rocks.
Right. Yes. So in law, or in international law, there's a distinction between islands, rocks, and low tide elevations. An island capable of sustaining human habitation gets up to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, fisheries, oil, gas. A mere rock that's simply a natural area of land above water at high tide gets you a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. And a low tide elevation, something that only bumps just above the water at the lowest possible tide, gets you basically nothing at all.
Tell me about the Mischief Reef, apart from having a wonderful name. Why is it significant?
The Mischief Reef is significant because it's one of the reefs on which China's been conducting land reclamation and has built something like three airstrips. Now, the Chinese position was, if this is a rock, then it's got a 12 nautical mile territorial sea and we might have historic claim to it. But the Permanent Court of Arbitration decision, or the Arbitral Tribunal decision, has said it's only a low tide elevation. So you can't be sovereign over it, China. Ownership of a low tide elevation goes with what zone it's in. And it's in the Philippine zone. So actually, this is enormously significant. It's a finding that China has built an illegal structure in someone else's exclusive economic zone.
I take it that the Philippines were persuaded to be the stalking horse in this complaint?
As far as I'm aware, they brought it entirely of their own initiative. I don't think any other state lent on them. And I think to some extent they took this action because the ASEAN grouping wasn't making a very strong collective position vis-a-vis China at the time.
Coverage, media coverage on the dispute has largely been about the potential for military conflict, but environmental war was highlighted specifically in the judgment.
Absolutely. In some ways, the strongest language of the tribunal was that where it found that irreparable damage had been done to coral reefs in constructing these artificial islands, and that violated China's duties to protect and preserve the marine environment.
Douglas, in your review of the decision, you say it's game-changing and it will be talked about for decades. Why?
The Law of the Sea dispute settlement system hasn't really been greatly tested under pressure until now. This is the first time a tribunal has really had to deal with a high-stakes case with effectively a superpower saying it won't appear. Russia didn't appear in the case with the Netherlands over the treatment of the Greenpeace vessel Arctic Sunrise, but that was about 30 people and a boat. This is about who gets sovereign rights and control over 80% of a critical area. So it really was important to see what a dispute settlement tribunal would do faced with that external pressure. And also, as a matter of pure law, this distinction between rocks, islands, low tide elevations, this is really important stuff. This is the equivalent for my field of sort of a major constitutional decision. There's going to be stuff to pore over in here for quite some time.
Douglas, are you surprised the decision, the judgment was so emphatic that it didn't seem to offer, quote, wiggle room?
I am surprised. I expected the Philippines to win, and I expected the Philippines to win decisively. I didn't expect it to be this straight down the line. And also in a contentious, charged case, having 5 out of 5 arbitrators agree on every single point, not a single dissenting opinion filed, is quite extraordinary. And it's closely written, and they have bent over backwards to include every public document or statement they can from China.
So, what's going on in Beijing as we speak?
Well, attempting to conduct a full-scale media campaign to discredit the tribunal and its ruling, it would seem. And that campaign started some time before the decision came down. So people often say to me as an international lawyer, well, what's the point of international law? It's always ignored. It has no effect. Well, China appears to think it's worth something because they're going to an awful lot of effort to discredit something they have said they regard as a nullity. This isn't how you treat a nullity. This is how you treat something of grave significance.
What are the prospects for mediation with the Chinese now, given the set of circumstances?
It's hard to see an obvious way forward. I think the call for calm and for all concerned parties to sort of step back and take a moment to assess their position is probably the right one. And in the long run, it might be possible to come to some kind of accommodation over perhaps shared or licensed use of some areas. But that could involve a considerable climb down.
What about the Chinese argument of historical rights? You know, this, they play the long game, and they seem to suggest that they've had this entitlement of way back in the past.
Right. So a significant part of the decision involves the question of how does a modern treaty interact with claims of historic rights? And effectively, the tribunal said, you can't have, having signed up to the treaty, you can't have preserved historic rights that are completely inconsistent with the treaty. The treaty allows for some bilateral special arrangements to be preserved, but historic rights incompatible with the convention can't be there. But more significantly, the tribunal actually, in looking at what China had said about the nine-dash line, said, well, wait a minute, you've consistently said to the Americans, you respect rights of overflight and freedom of navigation. You haven't said that what people get through the South China Seas is innocent passage. Now, innocent passage would be what you'd say about a territorial sea, something you actually claimed to have a status like territory. So the rights they were claiming were found, one, not to be very as significant as they might have been, and two, to be directly incompatible with the kind of rights other states would expect to enjoy in their EEZ. And to that extent, the treaty overrode any special claims. But further than that, many of the rights China had historically exercised were found to be but the basic rights of freedom of the high seas, navigation and fishing.
I think the Chinese should have hired you early on as a consultant, if not their legal representative. Look, thank you very much, Douglas. Douglas Guilfoyle, Associate Professor of Law at Monash University, and that's, I think, the most marvellous summing up you could possibly expect. Let's expect a similar standard from our next guest, B. Campbell, LNL on RN.